This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And welcome! Tom Hartman here with you. It is absolutely incredible. The dissonance. It's like different sounds in different ears. It's like different colors going off at the same time between these two stories that are essentially right at the top of the news. The one being all of this having to do with Iran. And, you know, larger, this larger issue that James Woolsey is out, saying, well, maybe we should nuke Iran, in effect. And, in fact, I think his actual claim was, he says, I'm afraid, well, at worst, a few months, at best, a few years, they could have a bomb, Iran. So he's talking about the, you know, and now this is the guy who in May of 2002, this was, sometime before we invaded Iraq, is saying it is urgent that we begin this process of bringing democracy to the Middle East before the region's most dangerous dictator, Saddam Hussein, gets nuclear weapons. Ah, yeah. And then in January, just before the invasion, January of 03, he says it would be a lot easier to stop Saddam now than it will 2 or 3 years from now when he is almost certain to have nuclear weapons. So, wrong before. But the White House, taking this kind of rhetoric very seriously, apparently. Top story in the New York Times today, U.S. weighing terrorist label for Iran guards. This is the Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. Now, this is the one side of the dissonance, is terrible things going on. Let's go after them, bad guys. Although it's weird because in the New York Times, there's a photo of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran with President Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan. And Karzai calling Ahmadinejad a brotherly neighbor, which is the opposite, as the New York Times points out, of what Bush says. So anyhow, here's the story. The Bush administration is preparing to declare that Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps is a foreign terrorist organization, senior administration officials said Tuesday. If imposed, the declaration would signal a more confrontational turn. This is Helene Cooper's article in the New York Times. In the administration's approach to Iran, it would be the first time that the United States has added the armed forces of any sovereign government to its list of terror organizations. So here we have the Bush administration just cranking this thing up to a high pitch. It's just as high and as loud as they can get. And of course, it always works well for them, or at least it always has worked well for them over the last 5-6 years. To play the be afraid, be very afraid card, to play the look over there so that you don't look over here card, to play the pay attention to what's going on internationally because domestically our country is being looted by Republicans. That's a card that has always worked very well for them. Now, here's the other side of it. This is yesterday's Wall Street Journal. I clipped this out yesterday. I was going to mention it on the air, and I was just in my stack. I never got to it. And it's interesting that today in the New York Times, this big headline, we're going to declare the army, essentially the largest part of the army of Iran, as a terrorist organization. This is something we've never done before with any government, actual government, to declare that their army is a terrorist organization. Bush wants to do this. At the same time, here's the flip side. This is from yesterday's Wall Street Journal. China's Chery, by the way, is the auto manufacturer in China that I believe General Motors has cut a deal with. I could be wrong on that, but I know that there has been talk about Chery being the first Chinese auto manufacturer to import cars into the United States. And it works out very well for China. When they export cars to the United States, we only charge about a 2% import tariff for cars coming in, whereas if General Motors tries to sell cars in China, China charges about a 20% import tariff when we import into China. So, anyhow, Chery Automobile Company of China said it signed an agreement with Iran Kodro Company, Iran's biggest automaker, and Canada's Solitac Inc. to invest $370 million in a plant to assemble cars for Iran and neighboring countries. Cherry said Kodoro will have a 49% stake, Cherry 30%, and Solitac 21%. In the first half, this was the first half of this year, Chery was China's fourth biggest car manufacturer by units sold, behind a General Motors Corp joint venture and two Volkswagen AG ventures, according to J.D. Power and Associates. Chery said the Iranian project will start operations in 9 months. So let's see. On the one hand, China and Canada, or Chinese and Canadian companies, and in China, a Chinese company and the Chinese government, you know, there's not that much daylight between the two, even though they are embracing capitalism aggressively. Nonetheless, it's a capitalism that works very well for dictators. It's capitalism the way it was played out in 17th, 18th century England. It's capitalism the way it was played out in Europe throughout much of the, you know, from the first through the 18th centuries. Capitalism where the capitalists operate at the discretion of, with the approval of, and to the benefit of the crown. Only in this case, it's the dictators of communist China. So anyhow, here you have this private corporation in China cutting a deal with Iran, and a company in Canada cutting a deal with Iran. At the same time that Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, sometimes referred to as the mayor of Kabul because he controls so little of the country now, the Taliban having taken back most of it, and the warlords. But nonetheless, Hamid Karzai, our guy, right, the former consultant to Unocal, the oil company, who's now the president of Afghanistan, sitting with the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and Ahmadinejad saying of Afghanistan, they're a brotherly neighbor, and Karzai agreeing. Very nice, cordial meeting. And at the same time, Bush is about to declare these guys as terrorists. Where is this leading? Where is all this stuff leading? And how are people pushing back? I'm going to tell you how the Germans are pushing back. This is a truly startling story. We'll get to that in a couple of minutes. But first, the larger frame here is ultimately the conservative versus the liberal worldview, the traditional conservative worldview of kings and hierarchy versus the traditional liberal worldview of democracy and a broad distribution of power rather than concentration of power. And this goes all the way back to the Enlightenment, to the 17th century, the 1600s, and John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Thomas Jefferson in the 1700s, and Ben Franklin and the founding of this country, the first liberal nation in a sea after 7,000 years of conservative rule, essentially in European countries anyway, with the single exception of a few hundred years there in Greece when we had democracy. Yesterday, I thought it was interesting, Chris Matthews made the observation yesterday. He said, I've always said that, I'm paraphrasing from memory here, but I think this is pretty close to it. He said, I've always said that Democrats want to have meetings and Republicans want to elect a leader. Now, that's A, there's a lot of truth to that. And B, what it illustrates is the liberal worldview embraces democracy. Let's have meetings. Let's talk about this. Let's work this out. Let's let everybody have a say in this. And the conservative worldview disdains democracy and embraces hierarchy, patriarchy, embraces presidents for life. Which brings us to family security matters. And a tip of the hat to the folks, the fine folks over at Democratic Underground who tracked this thing down and outed it. Family Security Matters is an organization that has recently taken down much of their website after it got outed over at Democratic Underground. And because there was an article, or at least, you know, this part of it, there was an article over family, and in just a minute I'm going to tell you who's on the advisory board of Family Security Matters, where this group came from. But they recently had an article up saying that President Bush should become president for life. This is quoting from the article. President Bush is reviled. He has become another victim of democracy. By elevating popular fancy over truth, democracy is clearly an enemy of not just truth, but duty and justice, which makes it the worst form of government. President Bush must overcome not just the situation in Iraq, but democratic government. However, President Bush has a valuable historical example that he could choose to follow. And that example? Caesar. When he pacified Gaul, when he invaded, you know, southern Europe, France, mass slaughter, he used his successful army to crush all political opposition and establish himself as the permanent ruler of ancient Rome. Bush should do the same. Who are these people? Right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Well, this is the human race side of the human race, but we're talking about the questionable. Is this the human race, or are these the lizard people? Time will tell. This Philip Atkinson wrote this article. He's a contributing editor to FamilySecurityMatters.org and founder of OurCivilization.com, author of A Study of Our Decline, apparently a book, and so over at Family Securities Matters, he writes this article. He says, if president, and he talks about, you know, democracy is the worst form of government, which, by the way, is sort of how Alexander Hamilton opened his speech to the Constitutional Convention in 1786, whatever it was. Wasn't it Winston Churchill who said democracy is a terrible form of government? But no better one has ever been found. Well, he's not saying that. He's actually saying that better ones have been found. He writes, if President Bush copied Julius Caesar by ordering his army to empty Iraq of Arabs and repopulate the country with Americans, he would achieve immediate results. Popularity with his military, enrichment of America by converting an Arabian Iraq into an American Iraq, thereby turning it from a liability into an asset, and boosting America's prestige while terrifying America's enemies. I would add that this is not some radical new idea. This was, as he correctly points out, this is what Caesar did. This is what the Spanish did in Central America and South America. They weren't entirely successful, but largely. This is certainly what the British did in North America to the Native Americans. So anyhow, Philip continues writing. He says, President, he could then follow Caesar's example and use his newfound popularity with the military to wield military power to become the first permanent president of America and end the civil chaos caused by the continually squabbling Congress and the out-of-control Supreme Court. President Bush can fail in his duty to himself, his country, and his God by becoming ex-president Bush. See, that's what's going to happen in 523 days, 12 hours, 30 minutes, 55 seconds. Or he can become president for life Bush, this conqueror of Iraq who brings sense to the Congress and sanity to the Supreme Court. Now, as I said, this has been pulled off FamilySecurityMatters.org's website, but over at Democratic Underground, you can find a link to the Google cache where they actually, you know, nothing ever vanishes from the Internet. You can actually read the article. So who is Family Security Matters? Well, it turns out that it's a front group for the Center for Security Policy. In fact, if you call the phone number listed on the Family Security Matters website, the people who answer the phone are the Center for Security Policy. This is a conservative Washington think tank, and who is on the board of advisors? Well, Dick Cheney. Actually, Dick Cheney is how he pronounces it. He kind of likes the fact that the rest of us pronounce it wrong. People from the Reagan administration, some names you may recognize, others you won't. Elliot Abrams, Ken DeGraffenried, Paula Dobriansky, Sven Kramer, Robert Joseph, Robert Andrews, J.D. Crouch. There's this very, very interesting collection of people who are pushing this very strange agenda. Family Security Matters is promoted by a fellow who's been a guest on this program a couple times, Frank Gaffney. and Family Securities Matters founder, security mom Carol Tabor. She was once a publisher of Working Woman magazine. She spent the 1960s protesting the Vietnam War and the 1980s as publisher of Working Woman's magazine, but now she's a conservative. Now they are working with Reagan-era Pentagon officials. This from townhall.com, from a Frank Gaffney article. Now they're working with Reagan-era Pentagon officials to raise $2.6 million to start a nonprofit monthly newsletter called Family Security Matters, aimed to help get women as allies for a hawkish stance in the war on terrorism. How to explain the transformation? Ms. Tabor says she was inspired by a talk that she heard the president of the Center for Security Policy, Frank Gaffney, give a year ago in New York. Ms. Bryan said she was moved by the attack on New York on September 11, 2001. It's like these are this is the crowd. And then you start looking at the board of directors, and Rain Dog tracked this down over a Democratic Underground. Barbara Comstock, principal of the former director of public affairs for the United States Justice Department, James De Graffenried, president and COO of the United States Naval Institute, Terrence Elks, former member of the board of directors and president and former CEO of Viacom, Frank Gaffney, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy, Laura Ingraham, radio talk show host, Roger Robinson, Paul, former senior director of international economic affairs at the White House National Security Council under Ronald Reagan, Paul Valley, major general, U.S. Army, senior military analyst, Fox News. I mean, this is starting to get a little strange. On the advisory board, Joan Woodward, executive vice president, deputy director of Sandia National Laboratories, James Woolsey, former director of the CIA, which is where we started this whole conversation 27 minutes ago, with James Woolsey going on CNBC, or going on CNN, rather, and saying, time to do something about Iran, you know, because they're going to have a bomb any day. Now, what does this say about the conservative worldview? We'll get to that right after this, and then your phone calls, 866-303-2270, 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
So hang on tight, the road may get bumpy. Dig your nails in and swallow your pride. I hope we're headed in the right direction. Might be driving you crazy, but we're loving the ride. I'm driving you crazy, but we're loving the ride.
Now, what you have to understand is the fundamental difference between the conservative and liberal worldview. Traditionally, I mean, from today all the way back to 7,000 years ago. You know, the Epic of Gilgamesh, the first rise of the city-state, at least in what we call Western civilization. That entire long history, and David, hand me that back, would you please? And by the way, let me just, I wanted to mention this, and I don't want to forget. Friday, by the way, just a quick heads up, I'll be in Los Angeles. I'll be doing the show live from L.A., from K-Talk, and also I'll be at the Landmark West Theater in L.A. at 5 p.m., for a Q&A for the screening of Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour. And at 7 p.m., it's actually at 6:30. I think it's 4:30 for the Q&A, and then 6 at the Landmark West, and 6:30 for the Q&A at the Arclight in Hollywood for the 7 o'clock screening of Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour. So be sure and check that out. And then on Monday we'll be in New York City, and next Friday we'll be in San Francisco. I'll give you those details a little later on. So here's the fundamental difference in these two worldviews is this, and I'm saying this without judgment. I mean, obviously I have a preference, but without judgment. The conservative worldview is that humans are fundamentally evil and flawed. Unlike everything else in nature, all of nature operates, you know, in ways that are fairly synergistic and predictable and in balance and in relative harmony. That's not to mean that the foxes don't try to eat the bunnies. But it means that there's always a balance between the foxes and the bunnies. Too many foxes, not enough bunnies. The foxes start dying off because they don't have enough food. You get more bunnies. You too many bunnies, not enough foxes. You have a problem. You know, then you have more foxes. And ultimately, you have balance. But somehow, in the conservative worldview, there's this belief, and it comes out of the belief that humans are divinely unique, that is created separate from all of the rest of creation. Or at least that's the mythology, or the story, let's say. that supports that worldview, that humans are uniquely evil. Everything else in nature is essentially neutral, but humans are evil. And therefore, institutions are put into place to constrain and restrain that fundamental evil nature of human beings. And this, by the way, was the dominant worldview in Western society, Western civilization, for 7,000 years, or for that matter, in much of Eastern civilization. And therefore, because people are evil, you needed kings, and you needed emperors, and you needed popes, and you needed wise people who could essentially control everybody else, because everybody else, the rabble, as John Adams used to refer to you and me, the rabble was evil and unpredictable. And in Greece, 3,000 years ago, they had this weird idea, what if we, the rabble, tried running the show? And it worked for a few hundred years, and then it went away. And nobody thought it could work again. And then in the 1600s, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, as Europe was reaching out across the world and conquering all these nations and exploring Africa and exploring the Americas, all these stories were coming back of the noble savage, Rousseau's phrase. What they were discovering was that these, quote, savage societies actually very often seemed to be very happy people who lived in relative balance, not only with their environment, but with each other. And Charles Darwin, you read his book, The Descent of Man, and it's schizophrenic. I mean, he goes back, and David Loy, Rhian Eisler's husband, David Loy has wrote one of the most brilliant books on this and put together the Darwin Project, which I'm proud to be on the board of advisors of, you know, looking at this, and that, because Darwin was almost schizophrenic about this. You read the Descent of Man, and in one chapter, in one part, he's going, but they're savages. And then, but they're happy. But they're savages. But they're happy. But they're savages. But they live in balance. But they're savages. But they're nice to each other. But they're savages. But they don't have war. And how could this be? Darwin, it was making his head explode. And this led to Rousseau and Locke and Jefferson and Franklin and all these guys saying, hey, wait a minute. Maybe the essential nature of humans is just like everything else in nature. It's either neutral or it's good. And if the essential nature of humans is good, then you can trust democracy, because if you have the maximum number of good people participating in the decision-making process, then you're going to have good decisions and you will have a government that functions. And when the American experiment was created in 1787 and the Constitution ratified in 1789 and our country came into being in the late 1700s after the Revolutionary War, it was a radical experiment in liberalism that the rest of the world was convinced was going to fail. And in fact, what has happened instead is that, you know, in the neighborhood of 100 of the 200 and I think it's 89 countries in the world are now democracies, more or less. So not only did it not fail, but it has become an infectious meme. But there are still conservatives who believe that people are evil, and because people are evil, we must have people running things rather than, we should have a person running things. We should have kings and emperors rather than a lot of people. Again, this another article that was over on the, by Philip Atkinson, over on the Family Security Matters website that has since been scrubbed from their website. But if you go over to democraticunderground.com and look for the thread, group that advocated Bush become president to life, linked to Bush administration itself, you'll find a link to the Google cache on this. He's writing about the Pax, the collapse of the Roman Empire. And he says a civilization can exist only so long as it dominates by violence all other communities. And the moment a dominant community recoils from violence, its rule is challenged. That is, it becomes attacked by all the other communities in one way or another as they attempt to assert their beliefs upon a faltering civilization. Technology has now sped up the nature of war. Once it required massive human effort to conquer a nation by use of arms, now it does not. It just requires resolve and an advantage in technology. And he summarizes this, Americans have a choice, use nuclear weapons on their enemies or have their enemies use them on Americans, ruthlessly uphold Pax Americana or blindly follow Pax Romana into oblivion. And this is the fundamental conservative worldview. And, you know, typically they're pretty upfront about it. For example, Justice Scalia. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Scalia. And again, Raindog quoted this over in the thread of Democratic Underground. This is just such a great thread. It's a tip of the hat to these folks. Scalia's infamous speech, God's Justice and Ours. And Scalia is talking about the death penalty and democracy. And he's talking about the modern aversion to the death penalty. He says, in my view, the major impetus behind modern aversion to the death penalty, and by the way, this comes back around to Gonzalez, wants to be able to speed up death penalty cases in the states. And Leahy and Arlen Specter are pushing back. But anyhow, this is Scalia. He says, in my view, the major impetus behind the modern aversion to the death penalty is the equation of private morality with government morality. This is a predictable, though I believe erroneous and regrettable, reaction to modern democratic self-government. You get it? He doesn't like democratic self-government. He says, few doubted the morality of the death penalty in the age that I believed, that in the age that believed in the divine right of kings. Or even in earlier times, St. Paul had this to say. I am quoting, as you might expect, the King James Version. And then he says, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers. He's quoting St. Paul. He says, these passages from Romans represent the consensus of Western thought until very recent times. Yes, until the founding of this country. Back to Scalia. Not just of Christian or religious thought, but of secular thought regarding the powers of the state. The consensus has been upset, I think, by the emergence of democracy. It is easy to see the hand of the Almighty behind rulers whose forebearers in the dim mists of history were supposedly anointed by God, or who at least obtained their thrones in awful and unpredictable battles whose outcome was determined by the Lord of hosts, that is, the Lord of armies. It is much more difficult to see the hand of God or any higher moral authority behind the fools and rogues, as the losers would have it, who we ourselves elect to do our own will. I'm quoting from Justice Scalia. The mistaken tendency to believe that a democratic government be nothing more than the composite will of its individual citizens has no more moral power or authority than they do as individuals has adverse effects in other areas as well. It fosters civil disobedience. Oh, my God. People might protest. St. Paul would not agree with that. Ye must needs be subject, said St. Paul, not only for wrath, but also for conscience sake. This is Justice Scalia. He says, for conscience sake, the reaction of people of faith to this tendency of democracy to obscure the divine authority behind government should not be resignation to it, but the resolution to combat it as effectively as possible. End of quote from Justice Scalia of the U.S. Supreme Court. We must combat democracy. This is also why conservatives love corporate power. It's why they're willing to hand over power, not to the United Nations, which is a democratic body, where all the states have a say, but rather to the World Trade Organization, which is a corporate body. Why? Because corporations are amoral. They are loyal only to profit. And because they are amoral, they have no morality. And people in the world, in the worldview of conservatives, are morally inferior, are evil. That an amoral institution is more desirable than an institution run by people, small d democracy, or governments. And similarly, that's why in the liberal worldview that says that people are essentially good and that we can actually govern ourselves, that we would say, no, we really don't want amoral institutions like corporations ruling the world. We'd rather have institutions of we the people, who we believe are moral, like the United Nations or the democracy called the United States of America, ruling our own country and determining our own destiny through our representation. 45 minutes past the hour. Your call's next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
So last night I was on Larry Kudlow's show on CNBC debating a guy named Jed Babin about whether or not, and this seems a little off topic, but it's really not, about whether or not Don Imus should come back. And I'm like, you know, A, I believe in redemption, you know, and second chances. And I'm sure he's learned his lesson. And B, I also believe in the marketplace. And if he can find sponsors and radio stations and a network, bring him back. And Jed Babin says, no, he shouldn't come back because he's a liberal. He was practically French kissing John Kerry. Well, the guy's, I believe, a registered Republican, but I didn't take that on. But in any case, so I'm looking at the Board of Family Security Matters, this group that had this article on their website for a while calling for Bush to become president for life. And there's Jed Babin, one of the contributing editors. Ah, well, interesting. Let's see, who disagrees with me the most here today? It looks like Brendan in New York City. Hey, Brendan, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good. What's up?
All right, so my basic argument with you on this whole notion that you put forward about the conservative ideology being inherently believing that humanity is evil and liberal philosophy inherently believes that humanity is good is that I think you're kind of citing mostly neoconservative sources. I'm kind of more of like a libertarian Ron Paul conservative. And I mean, that philosophy is for, you know, the legalization of drugs. And if you're going to legalize drugs, you're trusting human beings to be good and to not hurt other people when they use those drugs. And a lot of liberal philosophy, as far as, you know, the way I see it, is about, you know, regulation because, you know, I mean, corporations may be amoral and they may, by law, have to, you know, serve the profit motive instead of the public good. But, I mean, they're still run by people. And, you know, if a corporation...
Yeah, but they're not. Yes, they're run by people, but they're marching to a set of rules which we have oddly defined that say that they must perform based on one single value, not what's best for human beings, not what's best for the human race, not what's best for the planet, what's best for short-term profits or long-term profits.
What about
the
welfare state?
But Brendan, pause for just a minute. You've covered a lot of territory here. Let me respond. First of all, I'm suggesting that this worldview is I'm not quoting neoconservatives. I'm quoting Thomas Hobbes. Thomas Hobbes, back in 1638, in Leviathan, as I recall, 1630, it might be 1634, wrote that without the iron fist of government or church, that society, and I'm paraphrasing, it's his famous quote, but it's much longer than this, that society would break down and you would have no arts, no letters, and life would be nasty, brutish, and short. I mean, that was the worldview of conservatives. That if you read The Conservative Mind by Russell Kirk, published in 1953, it's still the Bible of the modern conservative movement. It's the book that William F. Buckley refers to. It's the book that Barry Goldwater referred to. It's the book that you know, all your modern major conservative thinkers refer to. Russell Kirk's first chapter is devoted to Sir Edmund Burke, who was a conservative thinker in the 1780s. And it was Sir Edmund Burke who said that he says it does me no violence if men such as tallow makers, candle makers, and hairdressers are allowed to ply their trades. He says, but it does society considerable violence if such men are allowed to participate in governance. In other words, to vote. That's traditionally been the conservative worldview, that people are essentially evil. I agree with you that the libertarians are saying, well, that's fine, let's legalize drugs and prostitution. But libertarians are also in their conservative philosophy saying, let's not have civic institutions making rules for all of us, because we can't trust all of us to do that because we don't trust democracy. And honest libertarians who come on this program have said many times on this program, right straight up, we do not believe in democracy.
Really? I mean, that sounds absurd to me. I don't know. Just all like, you know, even like the welfare state and having government take control of.
But see, that's democracy. It's not government. It's the government is us. Government is us, Brendan, in a democracy. If you don't believe in democracy, then a government is a them. If in the Soviet Union, the government was a them. In Mugabe's Zimbabwe, government is a them. You're absolutely right. But in a democracy, government is us. So if we collectively decide that we're going to care for that homeless guy down the street, that is not government taking your money. That's us collectively doing something democratic. And that's my point. Libertarians don't believe in democracy.
All right. Fair enough. I just wanted to shout out a book, The Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin. I think all of your listeners would really enjoy it. It's very important.
I agree. It's a great book. It's a very, very good book on the Fed. Yeah. Thank you very much, Brendan, for the call. And interesting conversation. Okay. Ultimately, yeah. You're right. We don't like democracy. Steve in Jackson, Tennessee. Hey, Steve.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
You know, I kind of disagree with you on a point. You know, whoever the next president is, I think the country needs to come together and back their foreign policy, whether it's Republican or Democrat. This can end up being endless wars.
Why should we all march in lockstep to anybody? That's anti-democratic. Democracy is about having a discussion, a debate, and ultimately doing what the majority of us decide to do within the context of the laws that created our republic.
They're prepared for endless wars because it's just like the Godfather when Sonny spoke up and all hell broke loose.
No, it's the exact opposite, Steve. And here, oddly enough, I'll have to refer you to a couple of neoconservatives, but there was a whole series of books that were published about, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 years ago. Hayakawa was the author of, or no, it wasn't Hayakawa. I'll have to go back and look. I wrote about them in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? And it's been 6 years since I wrote that book, but there was a series of books that showed that whenever a country became democratic, it did not invade other countries. That no two democracies, true democracies, where the people actually have a say, no two democracies in the history of the world have ever declared war on each other. It has never happened. And so if you don't want war, then you want more democracy. If you want war, then you want everybody marching in lockstep to the leader, which is what we have right now.
All I know is the war in Iraq would be over by now if we had some sort of consensus.
War in Iraq would be over now if we had more democracy, because the vast majority of Americans never wanted to go in the first place. If we had a more reactive democracy, if people in Congress were more reactive to we the people, we never would have had this war in the first place. The problem with the war is the philosophy that we all should have united behind Bush.
Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Well, continuing down the road of the differences in worldview and understandings of how society should be organized between conservatives and liberals, as it played out over the last 7,000 years, Devin Herrick is with us. He is a senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis, their website, ncpa.org, conservative think tank. Devin, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
Glad to have you here. I'm looking at the ncpa.org website, and does it say making ideas change the world? Is that the first word? Because it's covered up by the N in NCPA.
Yes,
the
absolutely.
Slogan? Yeah, okay. Interesting. And founded in the 1800s? Or is that nine...
I think that's like 1983.
It's a funny
we're
funny
not quite face. That old, 1800. Yeah. A little bit before there, us.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so here's the issue. The State Children's Health Insurance Plan, otherwise known as SCHIP, this is a program that Democrats in Congress, and a few Republicans are going along with this as well, are saying, why don't we expand this thing so basically not just terribly poor kids, and not even just poor kids, but essentially the working poor, the bottom end, or some would call it the middle class. We have a problem with definitions here, but nonetheless, people who are one paycheck or one illness away from disaster, that they're covered as well by this program. And, your think tank, the National Center for Policy Analysis, has come out and suggested that doing so is going to harm elderly people in the United States. I don't get it.
Well, if you look at the House version of the proposal, they would actually defund the Medicare Advantage plans that a lot of low-income seniors really depend on for the high-quality care.
You're talking about the private health insurance that people buy to fill in the donut, or the private health insurance that they can buy to, or are you talking about the drug program?
The Medicare Advantage plan, that is the plan that replaces traditional Medicare as well as the drug program as well as supplemental. It's one plan that encompasses everything that provides richer benefits than traditional Medicare does.
Right, and it's administered by private corporations, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, this is the one United Healthcare, the guy who William McGuire was the CEO of, who took a $1.78 billion paycheck when he left the company last year. That's the company that has the health plan that AARP is promoting for this. Why you know, why is defunding a program that is producing such a profit for corporations that, that Bill McGuire can take a $1.7 billion paycheck, a $1,700 million paycheck from our fees? Why is defunding that a bad idea? I mean, why not just say Medicare, the government is going to pay this? You know, Social Security has never failed to write a check.
Well, the reason why we think that's a bad idea is about one in five seniors is actually enrolled in one of these programs. And research has shown that about a little over $1,000 in additional benefits are provided through these plans directly to seniors. And so for that reason, a lot of the seniors that enroll in these plans are those that, that don't really have the money for that supplemental coverage or paying a lot of out-of-pocket costs. So they take these plans because they pay everything and they provide richer benefits, and a lot of low-income seniors really need these benefits.
Right, so why not do what the Democrats are suggesting and do away with that plan and do away with all those extra benefits and roll everything into Medicare and just say, sorry, Bill McGuire, you're not going to make $1 billion off us anymore. You know, sorry, Bill Frist and your buddies, you're not going to make billions of dollars off us anymore. We're going to have Medicare run like Social Security. It's a government program.
Well, and yeah, if you did that in the process, you would be telling, you know, about 8 million seniors, sorry, you can't have the extra $1,000 in benefits that you really need. In fact, you need to take
what the
government gives you.
You give it to them, but instead of having them pay that, you know, $1,000 in premiums to a private corporation, which is then, you know, administering the Medicare portion of it and handling the cash flow of the thing, you just have government. I mean, doesn't this really boil down to that guys on your side, and I say that respectfully, Devin, we're talking with Devin Herrick, of Senior Fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis, guys on your side view any expansion of Medicare or Medicaid or any of these programs where the government is paying for health care and where we are paying for the health care of ourselves through our taxes, you view that as socialism, essentially.
We look at that with suspicion because we don't think that the governmental system can administer these plans as efficiently or as effectively or, you know, as competitively as the free market. Governments tend to become very stoic. They, like in Britain, if you're someone who needs very serious cancer care, it's hard to get because most people are well. Therefore, most people, you please them by giving them those benefits that, you know, that are just marginal, like primary care. But
one of my very best friend's partner just died of cancer in the United Kingdom. In fact, I hopped on a plane and flew over there to spend a week with her and her family. And the care that her partner got was impeccable. It was extraordinary. And in her home, no less. I mean, it was... I don't think that the Brits would agree with you, Devin.
You do a Google search, and you'll find that the World Health Organization said that 25,000 additional unnecessary deaths occur every year from cancer because they don't have access to the latest medicines found routinely in Europe and the U.S. So it is a problem.
Okay, let me just give you then that the British healthcare system is not necessarily the one that we would choose. The British healthcare system is sort of like the Veterans Administration. It's socialized medicine, by and large. Not entirely, but by and large. Everybody, the hospitals are owned by the government. The doctors are employees of the government. The German healthcare system, on the other hand, or the French healthcare system, has, you know, private, not-for-profit hospitals. No corporations making a buck off it. And private physicians. And they're all paid for by a single payer, the federal government. And all of these countries now have a longer lifespan than we do. They have lower infant mortality rates than we do. They have better health than we do. And they're paying less than half of what we are. How is it that we're paying an average of over $10,000 per person in the United States for health care, and yet over 40 million of us are uninsured and another 50 million of us are underinsured, when the rest of the world is getting, the rest of the developed world, the other 38 countries in the developed world, are getting full health care benefits for less than $6,000 a person, and by and large are satisfied with it?
Well, the country you need to look at is Switzerland. They have personal and portable health insurance, and they have many of the attributes you described that are available in Germany, but they have a competitive market where you have health insurers competing for the business with long-term contracts, not renewed every single year. I think that would be a model for us to look at.
Well, they do in Germany, too. They do in Germany, too. I mean, you can get private health insurance. I used to live in Germany, and I started a corporation in Switzerland, and I've worked in Switzerland. And I'll tell you, the Swiss would describe their system as largely socialistic. It is not like ours. It is not where the only way you can get benefits is to be either old or infirm.
Well, and you raise an important point. Now, I mean, I'm not trying to defend our current system and say it's wonderful. It is badly in need of reform. It's just the question you pointed out earlier is, which way do we go? Do we look for private market forces to achieve that, or do we look for the government to allocate resources based on political pressures?
Right. Now, and ultimately, I think this is the bottom line question is how can we, or how can you believe, how can you assert that a corporation that is loyal first to profit and second to providing health care is going to provide health care as well as an institution that is answerable to we the people through our elected representatives and whose first and frankly only goal is to provide health care?
Well, because I think competitive pressures will create a lot of incentive. I mean, if I go to a big box retailer, they're trying to make a buck, but to do that, they found out they have to give me the best product at the lowest price. And that's the type of efficiency and competition I want to see in healthcare.
But if I'm having a heart attack, I don't have time to sit and dial around to five different competitors and find out who's got the best prices on heart care.
Well,
I mean, what's true for toys is not true for healthcare, in my opinion.
Well, there's a lot of healthcare that takes place that does not involve an ambulance. You're right. If I'm in the ambulance, I'm not going to be on my cell phone calling hospitals and having them bid on my business. But at the same time, my health insurance that I currently have, they've already negotiated discounts at a variety of hospitals. They might even have one that has the best quality and the lowest price and can advise me. But what I want to see is these firms competing to give me the best quality at the lowest price, and that currently isn't happening, and it wouldn't happen under a socialized system, and it isn't currently happening under our quasi-socialized system.
Isn't the bottom line here, Devin Herrick, that ultimately you don't trust government to do the right thing because ultimately, you know, we the people, the mob, the rabble here will, for example, if we had control over government, we would simply vote to give ourselves all the money, and you just can't, you really ultimately can't trust the rabble.
Well, I think you could. That's a little bit simplistic to what I'm thinking. But, yeah, I think you're correct that if you give politicians all of our resources, they will figure out how to maximize their votes as opposed to trying to fulfill my needs.
Whereas a corporation will try to maximize its profits.
Yeah, but the key is to make sure that they realize the only way they can do that is providing high-quality services at efficient prices.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, I think what we've done is highlight the issue because I think that ultimately that's the argument is, you know, who are you going to trust? You know, it's so interesting. Devin Herrick, senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis, ncpa.org, the website. Devin, thanks for coming on the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sure. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Out in Taiwan, my gallbladder out in Greece. Took a side trip up to Sweden to fill some caverns in my teeth. Saw a doctor down in Denmark and a specialist in Spain to see what could be causing me this dull but steady pain. Took a trip up to Toronto just to buy some little pills. Thought I'd died and gone to heaven when they handed me the bill. Went to Norway when I noticed that my eardrum had a hole. Got back home just in time to watch the Super Bowl. It's been a brutal year, but man, I'm glad I was overseas, where you can see the doctor when you really got a need. Where people, they live longer, babies also like they should. I guess they call it healthcare, and I guess they got it good.
I guess they call it healthcare. Oh, man. So what we're doing today is, or what we've been doing up to this point, and we'll continue at least through this hour, is just highlight, you know, pointing out the conservative worldview that says that a nation, ultimately a world, as in the World Trade Organization, but at least at the level of the United States, a nation run by corporations, a nation where the functions of government, the things that ensure life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are run by corporations, will be a better place in the view of conservatives than a nation run by small d democracy, that is, by government which is elected by the people and accountable to the people. And I would submit to you that where America went wrong, big time, was during the Reagan Revolution when we had the imperial presidency, the rise of the imperial presidency. And arguably this started under Nixon. Nixon started grabbing as much power as he could. And you had Karl Rove working in that White House, and you had Dick Cheney, you know, lurking around. And you have all the old players, right? And they got recycled through the Reagan administration, and now they're back again. And they really and truly do not believe in small D democracy. And if you push them, they'll tell you that. Well, democracy is messy. You know, it's just to paraphrase Don Rumsfeld, and I don't think I don't want to get into the whole Rumsfeld thing. But in any case, so I mentioned at the beginning of the last hour that I was going to summarize by telling you, and I will now, what the Germans are doing to try to raise the level of discussion and discourse in the world. And again, I think this comes back to the idea that, by and large, the Germans, having seen with their own eyes, or at least the previous generation, certainly with their history books, having seen what happens when uncontrolled power is consolidated in the hands of one person or one party, the Germans are out there saying, you know, let's be good citizens of the world. This is in today's Financial Times, an article by Hugh Williamson, writing in Berlin. He says, Germans holidaying abroad, vacationing abroad this summer, are being called on to, quote, look beyond the palm trees, end quote, and pester staff in foreign airports and hotels about human rights concerns. Now, who was the left-wing wacko who suggested that German tourists, when they go to airports in foreign countries, should say, are you respecting human rights? When they go to hotels in foreign countries, should say, are you respecting the rights of your lowest-paid workers? Who, when they're walking around the bazaars and streets and shops of foreign countries, should be saying, is your country respecting human rights? Who was this left-wing wacko? It was the foreign minister. Launching an unusual appeal to the 44 million Germans who travel overseas every year, Günther Nück, a close ally of Angela Merkel, the chancellor, and the foreign ministry's human rights envoy, said, quote, human beings were being trampled underfoot in top destinations such as Turkey, Egypt, and Thailand. He called for packaged holidays to be expanded beyond sightseeing and cultural highlights to include meetings with human rights activists. Airlines could also play their part. He says, why don't in-flight magazines include profiles of human rights activists alongside the usual glossy articles? He even suggested that tourists visiting the Olympics in China next year should organize, quote, private meetings, end quote, with local citizen groups, although he warned against actions that endanger visitors or locals. Regine Spertl of Amnesty International in Germany said she was thrilled by the appeal and said visitors to luxury hotels in Dubai, for example, should confront hotel managers over the working conditions of low-paid Bangladeshi staff women who regularly face human rights abuses. And perhaps German tourists to the United States. I could just see it now. German tourist walks up to you in the airport, says, hi, I'm a tourist from Germany. Why doesn't your country uphold human rights? This is from the Foreign Ministry of Germany, encouraging their 44 million Germans who are going to travel overseas this summer to hassle the rest of the world into honoring human rights. God bless them. Can you imagine if a president of the United States said something like that? The last president that we had to actually seriously talk about this, Bill Clinton did a pretty good job. Jimmy Carter was stellar. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. I don't know if it was a moment of unusual candor or if it was misspeak. Or you know, a Freudian slip area, but on Hardball with Chris Matthews, Aaron Burnett, who is with CNBC, does a show called The Street for CNBC, was talking about how poisoned toys in China, coming from China to the United States, are actually good for us. This just to wrap this this whole thing here. Here she is.
But inflation.
Let me turn this down.
But inflation, that's another interesting point, because a lot of people like to say scaremonger about China, right? A lot of politicians, and I know you talk about that issue all the time. I think people should be careful what they wish for on China. You know, if China were to revalue its currency, or China is to start making, say, toys that don't have lead in them, or food that isn't poisonous, their costs of production are going to go up. And that.
Now, wait a second. Let me just hear that again.
It means prices at one. To start making, say, toys.
Go back to the beginning.
Or China is to start making, say, toys that don't have lead in them or food that isn't poisonous. Their costs of production are going to go up. And that means prices at Walmart here in the United States are going to go up, too. So I would say China is our greatest friend right now. They're keeping prices low, and they're keeping prices for mortgages low, too.
Mm-hmm. Poison is good for the economy. It's true. She's absolutely right. Not that they're our best friend, but the poisoned toys and poisoned food, lead-based toys and poisoned food are seemingly helping not helping the economy. They're helping Walmart. And given that 26 years of conservative economic policies have devastated much of the middle class, and many, many people have now fallen into the category of working poor, and really their only option is to shop in the cheapest place, in part because, and Walmart is not always the cheapest place, by the way, but nonetheless, it's perceived as such, in part because they've driven all the local businesses out of business. Anyhow, Kim in Long Island, New York, listening on WWRL. Hey, Kim, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to talk about that issue. The fact that your last guest, Devin, I think his name was, said
Devin Harris,
that big box places have the best products at the lowest prices, and that's why they succeed. No, they have products at the lowest prices, and that's why they succeed, because they allow things like lead paint and child labor and everything else that we don't allow in this country, and so they can keep things at cheaper prices. And, you know, if you want a medical version, actually, I can give you a good example of what would happen in this country because of what's going on with me right now. I'm battling breast cancer. I had 15 minutes of fame on the YouTube debates because of it. And the first doctor that I saw wanted to chop off my left breast. He recommended chopping off my right one. He said that was the best way to go with it. Well, the doctor that I saw after I got on Medicaid is actually treating me and is now not only saving my life, but saving my breasts as well. So if we go with the kind of medicine that he wants, the cheapest, we might as well open up more landfills for all the bioproducts that are going to be out there, because all they're going to do is chop off things and chop out organs, because it's the cheapest way to treat it. Not the best way to treat it, not what would be right for the patient, but the cheapest way to treat it, and that's just not right.
That's an eloquent and excellent example, Kim. Thank you very much for the call and for making that
point.
Thank you. Much appreciated. Roberta in San Diego, California. Hey, Roberta.
Hi, oh,
and
Kim. How are you doing?
I'm fine. And let me just toss back to Kim, our last caller. You know, good luck in your battle against breast cancer. We all wish you the very best. Roberta,
yeah,
what's up?
And I send her the same wishes as a 64-year-old woman I've been through something similar. Anyway, you know, all I can say is, oh, my God, can we please get these horrid monsters out of our White House? I mean, that guy that you had on just put me in a seething rage.
Well, they're not just in our White House, Roberta. They're in Congress. You've got the Blue Dog Democrats. You've got the entire Republican Party. They're in the House. They're in the Senate. They're in the think tanks. They're in the media. They basically control virtually all of the talking heads on cable TV, with the exception of Keith Olbermann. God bless him. I mean, that's.
I know. Let me say what I had to say, which is quite a bit, actually. You know, I am a disabled senior. I have a young voice, but I'm 64, and I'm living well below the poverty level. And I speak for millions of invisible seniors across America. This man's words put me in a seething rage, and they also, you know, put me to tears. Millions of seniors are dying in their homes all alone and in poverty thanks to the cold, cruel, inhumane practices of the Bush administration. And so are millions of children and families slowly dying as a result of it. Health care and Social Security both being cut down to nothing. You know, any indigenous tribe knows that when you stop taking care of your elders and your children, your tribe is doomed to die. But people like this guy you had on, Devin, and George Bush and Dick Cheney, they don't know about anything like that, and they don't care about anything like that. They don't care about humans and humanity. And we're sick of it. You know, we're sick of it. We want these people out. You know, they need to get out of our White House and out of our society. I mean, maybe they could just go live on another galaxy somewhere, not that anyone would want them there. And what I find interesting is their voices all sound kind of the same. They have these very irritating, creepy voices, like they're all clones of one another.
Well, you know, let's not get into the personal attacks on them. But really, the bottom line here is it goes back to, and rather than talking about the Bush administration, it goes back really to conservative philosophy.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And then you've, of course, got Rush Limbaugh coming along saying,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And the policies of Roosevelt that they're doing something about are things like Social Security. They want it, you know, turned over to private corporations.
Yeah, well, I just hope the people in this country can all stand up strong together and make the changes that need to be made, which are significant and almost overwhelming. But we just really have to do this, because otherwise our human tribe is in serious trouble.
Yeah, well said. Roberta, thank you very much. Nancy in Alton, Illinois. Hey, Nancy.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine.
What's up? Great. You know, the topic of the low-quality products made by China that are getting distributed through Walmart was the topic that was discussed on Daily Kos recently.
And yeah, it's not just Walmart, by the way. Mattel is all over the place.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
yeah. Well, this was, I think we were specifically talking about how it seems like that a lot of these products are getting pushed off on a kind of a lower socioeconomic section of America, because they're more desperate to find something that's cheaper. It's really hard to think about China and the U.S.'s economic greed when your biggest concern is how do I stretch $30 to feed 4 people for a week?
Right.
And
exactly.
That it seems to be, that's who's getting hurt the worst. The rest of us who are looking at this and looking at the line of how this goes, we can say, well, we don't like Walmart, we don't like how they do business, and not shop there. And these other people where they live in these areas where Walmart's the only option and where their money just cannot go that far, they're sort of stuck in that cycle.
No, absolutely, and very well said, Nancy. And in fact, it's not just that. They also are less likely to be active politically. They're less likely to be political activists or to be, quote, troublemakers. You know, they're less likely to behave like the rabble if they're terrified. If they're, you know, how do we stretch $30 for 4 people for this week? And so there's a political benefit to the conservatives as well as a financial benefit. Kurt in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on WPTT. Hey, Kurt.
How you doing?
Good.
One observation I had was, when I'm a painter, and I'm basically around a lot of different people, working class people, and when I do hear conservative talk from people, a lot of times there's a patriarchy-matriarchy issue with it, where people want to trust the government when it's doing something militaristic and warlike if they're conservative, but when you try to help somebody through the government, there's a distrust with it, and I find it psychologically very interesting.
Yeah, they have no problem with the government killing people.
Right.
Capital punishment, for example, or war, as you point out. Which is the male warrior archetype, I guess, in our culture. But the nurturing mother archetype, and this George Lakoff writes about this at some length. The nurturing family, the nurturing parent, the nurturing mother in particular, and Breanne Eisler talks about and has talked about in this program, that aspect of government, conservatives are terrified of. And it may have something to do with the terror of women. I don't know. And
yeah.
I don't want to try and get too much into psychobabble here. But,
right.
Kurt, good point. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Gene in San Francisco. Hey, Gene.
Well, hi, Tom. I wanted to address what you were talking about earlier. A big part of what you described as conservative ideology and conservative philosophy, I see as reactionary, royalist, / authoritarian, / elitist rationalization and propagandizing. From reading John Dean's book, Conservatives Without Conscience, I think by now we should understand that 30% of the population is easily manipulated, and I feel this fact is a substantial one and should be considered. Because what you describe and what Newt Gingrich refined and what Karl Rove uses, they're not so much an ideology, but rather a rationale and propaganda created to consolidate their power through attracting and holding authoritarian types.
But there's an ideology behind that which says that this is actually the optimal way for humans to live because you can't trust democracy.
Well, I think historically that might be true, but I don't think it's true anymore. And
you think that Karl Rove and George Bush actually believe in democracy? I don't.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that either. But I don't think it has anything to do with ideology or philosophy. It has to do with profit and power. And they're
pure and simple.
So many of the antisocial attitudes, including racist and elitist beliefs, lend credence to this idea of ideology and philosophy, I don't think it's deserved. I'm willing to debate ideology, but I don't want to debate just propaganda.
Yeah. Good point, Gene. Thank you very much. What's interesting to me is that when you talk to these guys, even the ones who just seem like they're all about, you know, how much profit are we going to make? I find consistently that there actually is an ideology back there. There is a worldview. I think everybody has a worldview fundamentally. And their ideology, as I said, is patriarchal and hierarchical.
Just a mile up the road. Take it in, take it with you when you go. Who says you can't go home?
And check it out on Friday. I'll be broadcasting live from KTalk in Los Angeles. And that evening I'll be at two different theaters in the Los Angeles area doing questions and answers before the showings for the opening of Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour. You can get the information, go over to tomhartmann.com and just scroll down to our schedule and click on it. And you'll find links to the theaters and you can buy movies or buy tickets in advance and the whole thing. On Monday in New York City, on Monday and Tuesday actually in New York City, I'll be there. Again, that's over at tomhartmann.com. Click on our calendar. And Friday the 24th in San Francisco, and then we'll be also a screening here, an advanced screening, August 29th here in Portland, Oregon. 1-866-303-2270, Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph, quick comment you wanted to make about Bush and Caesar?
Yes. Quick image for you. The white horse of the new Caudillo, the new Caesar, must wade through the blood of those who wanted him to overthrow the Republic. Otherwise, he won't be on the horse very long. The first thing Caesars have to do is to protect their power, and that means to kill those who had power before them. That includes their friends. Remember Cicero, Caesar's good friend?
Sure, sure.
Caesar was a good friend, but one of the first orders that Caesar signed was a death warrant for Cicero. As a friend, Caesar sent a fast messenger to Cicero so Cicero could commit suicide before Caesar's execution squad arrived. Now, these people who say they want an American Caesar don't know it. But he isn't going to need any powerful corporations, think of Adolf Hitler, no neocons, and certainly no religious fanatics who pray to God and not to Caesar. The people that want Caesar in the United States will be the first ones he slaughters.
Yeah, very interesting.
Justice.
Yeah, I guess so. Tragically. Ralph, interesting point. Very interesting point. Although Hitler did have the help of the largest corporations in Germany, and it was a fascist government. It was the merger of corporate and state enterprises. Alan Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. TalkRadioNews.com, the website. Hey, Alan.
Good morning or good afternoon. The gaggle that Dana Perino did in Crawford, Texas, really reads, and this was just done a couple hours ago, really reads like a playbook of what's going on. She was asked about the story that was in the Post and the New York Times today, Washington Post, about whether Iran's military was a terrorist organization. She kicks that right down the street to the Treasury and State Department in terms of sanctions and does not deal with it, does not deal with whether the president is considering doing it. You know, obviously somebody leaked it, so they're putting it out there, and then the White House is in denial and saying, well, you have to check with Treasury and State Department.
So you think this New York Times story, front-page story today about that the Bush administration is considering designating the Iranian military as a terrorist organization, something we've never done with any nation state before, that this was an unintentional leak out of this administration?
I think it's an intentional leak.
Yeah, that was my take.
Absolutely.
But it sounds like I thought you just said that Dana Perino...
It's put it out there and then deny it. Put it out there and then deny it.
The old trial balloon trick.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the question is whether... the question then was asked, well, what about the Security Council dragging its feet? And she then put that off to the State Department again, did not want to deal with that. So she's letting the State Department and Treasury Department sort of do it so that the White House looks like they're away from the story. The second thing she talked about was whether another leaked story today, well, it's not even leaked, I think people kind of know this, that the September Iraq report is written by the White House and whether that's going to happen rather than Petraeus. And she basically said, well, Congress asked for these reports from the president. They asked the president to report to the Congress, and so that the July 15th report will be no different than the September 15th report and how that works. And then she said the president's going to take recommendation from Petraeus and Crocker, and then he'll consult further before deciding on any possible course of action. So essentially the White House is going to be writing those reports.
So, and regardless of what Petraeus said, we're not going to hear Petraeus' report. This much ballyhooed, let's wait until September and hear what General Petraeus has to say. We're never going to hear what he has to say. We're going to hear what George Bush has to say about what he thinks about what Petraeus might or might not have said to him that is not part of the public record.
Now,
is that, do I have it right?
Is whether Congress then gets Petraeus before them and asks questions, which, of course, they're entitled to do. And what Petraeus says. So that is going to be pretty interesting.
Yeah, that part of it could be very interesting. Charles Colson and Richard Nixon, at the end of Nixon's first term in office, well, actually at the beginning of his second term, Watergate, the story broke just before the elections, but it really didn't go anywhere. And you know, it was the first month or so of his second term, and he and Chuck Colson sat down and had a long conversation that was just recently released at the Nixon Library about how Colson was going to go with much fanfare off to spend more time with his family. But what in fact he was going to do was, in the background, he was going to run a hatchet operation against Democrats and actually be even more effective than he was inside the White House. Any sense that Rove is playing the exact trick that Nixon played with Colson?
Well, it's hard to know whether it's an exact trick, but to say that Rove is going to stop having influence at the White House, I just think he's leaving to get other forms of pay. But that doesn't mean, you know, in these days of the telephone, all you need to do is have a 15 or 20 minute conversation with the president.
Yeah, Karen Hughes is still advising George Bush. She's down in Texas, isn't she?
No, Karen Hughes is up at the State Department.
Oh, she came back. That's right.
Our foreign policy, and I kind of think making a mess of it.
Yeah. Okay, thank you for the reminder.
He's still very much there.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Stick around. We're going to be talking about the Blue Death right after the news at the top of the hour. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. You're tuned into the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you do know, and sometimes even everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is everything you know about water wrong? Dr. Robert Morris is with us. He's the author of a new book, The Blue Death, Disease, Disaster, and the Water We Drink. Dr. Morris, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Glad to have you with us. First of all, the Blue Death, this refers to, is it cholera vibrato? Is that the name of the organism, as I recall?
Right. Well, cholera, ironically, it's a waterborne disease that kills people by dehydrating them. And when they get dehydrated, they can't get oxygen to their body, and they turn blue. And so when cholera was rampant, people called it the Blue Death.
Right, and because they're cyanotic when they... So your book is tracking this arc from the times of the Blue Death. I remember reading some of Edgar Allan Poe's letters, and he had essentially fled up into upstate New York. As I recall, it was like in the 1830s, was it? Was this before the Civil War or just after? I frankly don't remember the time period.
The first epidemic was in the 1830s, that's right.
Yeah, that was my recollection, was that it was the late 1830s. And he had fled up to upstate New York because New York City was having a cholera epidemic, and all of his friends, not all of his friends, but many of his friends had died. And you know, he's writing about this and how terrified everybody was about this. This was the beginning of, I should let you tell the story. The beginning of public health with regard to water in the United States.
Well, people had no idea what was causing this thing, and that was perhaps as terrifying as anything, was people would get sick for no apparent reason. And people simply couldn't believe when a physician by the name of John Snow started saying that this was waterborne. They just couldn't believe that something completely invisible could be killing thousands and thousands of people. And it took decades before people really became convinced that drinking water could make people that sick.
Right. And so we started chlorinating water. And in your book, you talk about the byproducts of chlorination. And in fact, you talk about a conference that you were at. The second day of the meeting, I found a seat in the vast generic meeting hall, and the first speaker was to directly address the epidemiology of disinfection byproducts and chlorination byproducts. And first of all, chlorination byproducts, there's a concern here?
Well, pretty much any water has some organic matter in it, whether it's rotted leaves or whatever. Even the purest mountain water's got some organic matter in it. And when you add chlorine to it, it forms this whole slew of chlorinated chemicals, and many of them are toxic. And there's now, I think, a lot of evidence to suggest that these chemicals can cause cancer.
So many of the cancers that people are experiencing in the United States and other developed countries may be a consequence of drinking the chlorinated water that prevented them from dying of cholera.
Right. I mean, I one of the reasons I went into the history of water in the book is I wanted people reading it to really appreciate the dramatic improvements that purifying water have made in terms of public health, and not to just say, well, if chlorine makes these bad chemicals, then we should just get rid of chlorine.
Sure.
It's not nearly so simple, and chlorine has saved many, many lives. So it's, as you say, it's allowing people to live long enough to die of cancer. But,
well, this is why I'm assuming why you named the chapter The Two-Edged Sword. You talk about, if I had any doubt about the agenda of the EPA, it disappeared as I listened to the speaker on the next panel, Pat Murphy, an epidemiologist for the Drinking Water Office of the EPA. What's the EPA's role in all this, and what's the agenda that you were talking about?
Well, I think the EPA, at this particular meeting, I had just put out a paper on chlorination byproducts and cancer, and I was a bit naive, I suppose, because what I didn't recognize is the EPA has, you know, they have put their stamp of approval on the water quality standards, and if you raise questions about the water quality standards, you are implicitly attacking the EPA. And there were many people within the EPA that were very uncomfortable with that notion. It's a big agency, and there's a diversity of opinions that tend to rise and fall depending on who's in the executive office. But
mm-hmm. toward the end of the book, you're talking the worst place on earth. You start talking about Zaire. I worked in Uganda in 1980 and 81 during the war with Idi Amin and after in the refugee camps. And the only thing that we could drink, the people who were doing relief work there, was Ugandan beer. And it was really funny. The label had the logo, you know, on the label for whatever the, I forget the brand now. And then in the little arc, the circle around the logo where normally it would say, you know, like Budweiser, the king of beers kind of thing, you know, the slogan, it in a 14-point type, you know, in fairly large type, it said, made with approved additives. And you open this beer and it smelled like chlorine. And we would, you know, the only, well, yeah, and here, you know, I was in a refugee camp where, you know, part of my work was in the morning, you'd find the people who had died of starvation the night before and take them out to bury them, you know, with a backhoe. And we would carry rice in our pockets and in the morning put a handful of rice into a bottle of beer with approved additives, and it would soak for 4 or 5 hours. And then that was my meal for the day, you know, and most of us were eating that way. But that was the only thing we could drink because the water was just so, I mean, parasites and all kinds of things. Water, you know, everybody's worried about running out of oil and, you know, peak oil. But one of the points, at least my take on it from reading through your book, I haven't read every word of your book, but I've spent some time with it, is that you're of the opinion that water is really the resource we need to be watching.
Well, I think we will see wars over water, you know, within the decade. I think water is... There was just a report out in Australia that said in 10 years, every major city in Australia is going to have to find new sources of water because of droughts, whether that's climate change or not. I'll let others debate. But, you know, populations are increasing, that you're putting more things into the water. The demand for water is increasing, and the infrastructure that supplies it is deteriorating. So yeah, we've got problems ahead when it comes to
water. Sydney, Australia, notoriously has periodic infestations of a particular parasite. I got it when I was there. I just had the most god awful food poisoning and had to go through, you know, three different antibiotics, and one was an anti protozoal or something that gets into their water system, and then they have to hyperchlorinate it. And I mean, it's just, this was a decade ago, but, you know, a lot of problems there. But the next step with regard to bottled water, you suggest that very often, you know, the difference, well, let me let you say it. What's your take on bottled water?
I think, you know, bottled water is just not a good solution as far as providing clean water. I mean, it's interesting because it tells you that if people are going to spend $15 billion a year on bottled water, they're concerned about water and they're willing to spend a lot of money on it. I just think there are much better solutions in terms of providing the water at a reasonable cost and not producing a tremendous volume of plastic and not using tremendous quantities of energy to move water around.
Right. And in your future of water, from E. coli to Al Qaeda, E. coli to Al Qaeda, the final chapter of the book?
Yeah. Well, I think, I tried to lay out, you know, in each area of drinking water what the issues are that I think we need to be concerned about. I think, you know, one thing is emerging pathogens, things like Cryptosporidium and E. coli that have caused major outbreaks and killed people. And,
yeah, Cryptosporidium, I think, was the one in Sydney, wasn't it?
My understanding is that Sydney has had a lot of problems with Cryptosporidium. I am not intimately familiar with them.
Yeah, because I remember it's the one that beavers poop in the streams.
That's Giardia, and that's another.
Oh, Giardia. One. Yeah, right. Yeah.
But I certainly think that one problem we have to worry about is emerging pathogens. We designed our treatment systems to take care of cholera and typhoid. They do a pretty good job of that, but we're working with a moving target when we're trying to eliminate waterborne pathogens.
It's a very thought-provoking book and a fascinating insight. The Blue Death by Dr. Robert Morrison. Disease, Disaster, and the Water We Drink. Dr. Morris, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks very much. If you want more information, go to thebluedeath.com.
Thank you for pointing that. TheBlueDeath.com. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
21 minutes past the hour. Friday, I'll be in Los Angeles, broadcasting live from K-Talk. And we'll be doing, showing up and doing a Q&A at two screenings of Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour, in New York. I'll be there on Monday and on Friday of next week in San Francisco at the Landmark Embarcadero. You can get all the information. Go over to TomHartmann.com and just click on my schedule, and there's links to the theaters where you can even buy tickets and things like that. And if you got 10 or 20 friends you want to bring along, you can do that as well. We'll also be in Portland, Oregon on the 29th of August for a screening of the movie 11th Hour at the Oregon Fox Tower. So it's going to be – this is an amazing movie, an absolutely amazing movie. We did a sneak peek in New York last week. And this movie picks up where Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth left off. And it goes so much farther and does, frankly, in my opinion, such a better job, which is not to put down Al Gore at all. He produced a brilliant movie, but this is a masterpiece. And, you know, produced by a guy who really, and starring a guy who really knows how to make a movie. And it's, but it's marvelous. Goldman Sachs. This is interesting. In the Financial Times today, I want to get into economics just for a minute. Actually, before I do that, just lest anybody else send me any more email on this, number of people, last week we were talking about the history of political smears and how Rove apparently had engineered the Bush smear of John McCain in South Carolina in the 2000 election, where people were called Republicans. White Republicans in South Carolina were called just before the primary, days before the primary, and asked, if you knew that John McCain had fathered a child with an African-American woman out of wedlock, would that change the way you vote? And, of course, it wasn't true. He and his wife have adopted a child from Bangladesh who has dark skin, but and that would cause those people to look at those pictures, those family pictures, and go, oh. It wasn't true, but it worked. And after John McCain had trounced George W. Bush in the primary... Pardon the sneeze there, had trounced George W. Bush in the primary in New Hampshire. McCain lost to him in the primary in South Carolina because of this classic Rove technique and strategy. And I said, we did have a president who had a child out of wedlock, and it was actually a campaign issue. And I had said that I had thought that it was somebody other than, I don't even want to get the name wrong again because it'll stick in your brain, but it turns out it was Grover Cleveland. Who, as I recall, was about the only Democrat who was president—a Democrat, oh no—during the robber baron era, and had some very good things to say about the robber barons, about them crushing the average American under the iron heel of capitalism. But the slogan, in fact, that was used against him was "Ma, Ma, where's my pa? Living in the White House? Ha, ha, ha!" It's a rather famous thing. And then, of course, Mr. Buchanan. Was America's only gay president, and his lover, Senator King, was America's only gay vice president. At different times, they were, although they had talked about running together. So, interesting, a little bit of history there. Now back to the economy. Confidence among some of the world's top business leaders. This is from today's Financial Times. Lena Sonoy in London. Confidence among some of the world's top business leaders has slumped to its lowest level. Since the third quarter of 2002, suffering from concerns about financial market volatility and mixed U.S. economic data. That's headline number one. Headline number two, Deborah Brewster in New York. U.S. banks refuse to accept subprime collateral. Now, this is something that, I mean, how much longer can the Fed, can the Central Bank of the United States, or for that matter, central banks of other countries, pump cash into, you know, try to raise liquidity in a system that, you know, where within the system, the banks are saying, no. U.S. banks caught in the credit market upheaval have started refusing to lend money against hedge funds' subprime credit portfolios. Hedge funds and several banks in recent days had cut off lending to funds that use credit portfolios, including mortgages. And there's the bottom line, if you're, you know, if you're one of these huge hedge funds or if you're invested in these subprime mortgages, it's a problem. Now, this is a relatively recent experiment, and this is the thing that I find really interesting about this, is this whole idea that that allowing banks, rather than holding mortgages, to sell their mortgages and then bundling those and selling them in the secondary market is a relatively recent thing, and it has never gone through a major economic cycle. And today in the Wall Street Journal, credit crisis hits small lenders, mortgage loan backlash spurs halt in operations, bigger rivals swoop in. The experiment's melting down, and one of the results is that the smaller mortgage companies are being eaten up by the big ones. They have to. Loan volume at Delta Home Loans, Inc., a mortgage bank in Los Angeles that specializes in loans for people who can't document their income, has dropped about 50% since June, says Adi Harari, the owner and chief executive. He says the volume has dropped to the point where we need to merge in order to survive. So smaller credit organizations, smaller funding organizations, smaller mortgage organizations being eaten up by larger ones. One consequence of this. Another great thing if you think that Walmart is the ultimate model for the world, I suppose. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Radio. Feel the music playing soft and slow. Radio.
34 minutes past the hour, our number 866-303-2270, TomHartman.com and AirAmerica.com. If you want to drop by and participate in our blog over at AirAmerica.com, our message boards over at TomHartman.com, or our live chat room, which you can reach from both. So lots of resources there. Let's take a quick look at what's going on in Iraq, and then we'll head over to the telephone lines.
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the barrels.
The following are security developments in Iraq as of 1400 hours GMT on Wednesday. U.S. forces killed 11 suspected insurgents and detained four others during operations targeting al-Qaeda in central and northern Iraq, the U.S. military said. In Kirkuk, a roadside bomb killed one person and wounded two others. In Najaf, a gunman on a motorbike killed a member of the Iraqi Joint and U.S. Security Coordination Center. In Daura, insurgents killed three police commandos and wounded two others. In Baghdad, a sniper killed two people on Al-Kaifa Street in central Baghdad. In Madian, gunmen killed one person and wounded another. In Hilla, at least five people were killed and 12 wounded with a suicide bomb attack at a judge's house in Hilla. In Biruz, at least one resident was killed and 13 wounded in clashes between insurgent gunmen and Iraqi security forces. And in Mosul, a suicide car bomb targeting an Iraqi police patrol killed one policeman and wounded four others in that city. And, of course, the death toll and the horrific bombing from yesterday now looking to be near 200, over 250. This is from the bombing that happened up near the Syrian border in Iraq. True tragedy. Got an email here from Chris, and it's ironic. This is something Louise and I were talking about last night, when this revelation that another zillion toys coming from China are lead contaminated, even baby bibs contaminated with lead. And Chris notes, we now believe that lead has a direct link to autism. Now, a lot of people have been looking at mercury on this, right? But lead, we know that lead poisoning is a neurotoxin. He says 20 years ago, the autism rate in the U.S. was 1 in 10,000. Now it's 1 in 150. We opened our markets to the Chinese about 20 years ago. Is this a coincidence? I think someone needs to investigate this possible connection. I'm really curious about that as well. I got to say, yeah. 1-866-303-2270, Ken in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Nice to hear from you. I wanted to call you because I have a story about why I stopped listening to KFI in Los Angeles. And why I started listening to K-Talk.
Okay. KFI is the conservative station.
Exactly. I initially wanted to listen to the other side of things because I wanted to have a more rounded view of the world because, you know, you want to understand things on all sides. It was very interesting because I was listening to the show for a couple of months, and all of a sudden...
So let me just pause you for a second.
Yeah.
You wanted to listen to which other side, and you were listening to what show?
I'm liberal, and I wanted to listen to the more conservative side so I could, you have a more rounded view of the world.
Okay.
And I was listening to the John and Ken show, and I think it was John or Ken who had a local sociologist on, and he was talking to him about some issues. And there was, and all of a sudden, the sociologist was talking about the fact there was a certain.
Ken, let me just pause you right there.
Yeah.
I really don't want to, you know, get into the details of somebody else's show on this show. Is there a specific point that you wanted to make that's larger than that?
The point was all of a sudden this guy was giving him direct knowledge, you know, direct data of what he had learned, and the John or Ken kept on saying, "Well, I don't believe you," and the sociologist is saying, "Well, this was just data,"
I got it, Ken. So your point is, I'm assuming that in your opinion, conservative talk radio is not paying attention to facts. Is that a good summary?
And the sociologist said, "You know what? I feel sorry for your listeners." That very moment, I switched over to listen to you guys, and what turned me on mostly was when listening to you and listening to Ed Schultz. When new information came up, when you guys hear new information, you say, I didn't know about that. Let me think about that. And I realized, oh my goodness, there's actually thinking people who are out there. And I just wanted to tell anybody who listens to conservative radio that they really ought to think about listening to
progressive talk radio. Yeah,
progressive talk radio. So that's a big
thank plus. You. Thank you very much, Ken. Although you're on this. Because talking to the choir, John in in Oregon, not in what city are you in Oregon, John?
Dufour.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Hey, John, what's up?
I was going to ask you what's up. We're used to hearing George Bush and John Hagee calling themselves Christians, but you called yourself a Christian yesterday, and I just realized that. Barack Obama called himself a Christian a couple of weeks ago. What's going on here?
Well, I think that there's a whole lot of Christians out there who are Democrats or who are liberals. In fact, I would say specifically and explicitly that the first, you know, worldwide well-known liberal was Jesus. And, you know, saying very clearly that we all have an obligation to take care of all of us. I mean, it's just it's pretty straightforward, in my opinion. But, you know, thank you for the call and for the question. Ann in Orange County, California. Hey, Ann.
Hey, Tom. I'm a mortgage underwriter, and I've been in the business for 20 years. And I was just calling to comment on your statement about the companies being swallowed up. And while I'm really sensitive to that whole thing, there's also a cycle. There's this little underground of mortgage people that pop out when we have the situation like we just had in the one in the early 90s that will open up shops real quick, and people will change careers for a few years when they see the boom time coming on. So there's a bunch of them that will fold once the happy days are over. So I'm hoping that a bunch of that is that. But I did see some congressional hearings because I'm on disability right now. And it was very interesting seeing the Democrats question the big financiers, and they were saying how they had been trying for years, the Democrats, to get Greenspan to tighten controls on underwriting, which had gone insane. I couldn't believe every time a new rule would come along and say, oh, now you don't have to verify this. I was
Fannie's doing this? Right, these so-called ninja loans, no income, no job loans. Let me just share with you the first sentence or two here from this article in today's Financial Times. They say the turmoil in financial markets is providing the first serious test of the new securities-based global financial system and of claims that it is inherently superior to the traditional bank-based system it is gradually displacing around the world. Many mainstream economists have long preached the benefits of the securities-based Anglo-American model in which banks originate loans but sell them on to investors rather than keeping them on their own books. And then they go on to talk about how this is a giant experiment and it's all very recent. If you were in this business, when did they start changing the rules?
It's absolutely insane, and they were saying how Greenspan, when he was warned by Congress, he went and relaxed the rules, and I know it had to do with George Bush and keeping this economy going. I know it in my gut.
Was it right after 9/11?
They got Fannie and Freddie sucked into it. They keep saying subprime loans. Fannie and Freddie have been doing subprime loans, and
right,
they automated it all, so it zipped right through. It was frightening.
Yeah, and thank you, Anne. Fannie and Freddie, of course, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac being the two government, quasi-governmental institutions. They originated as government chartered corporations. Fannie Mae back in 38, as I recall, and Freddie Mac in the 70s. As I recall, I'd have to go back and look at my timeline on all this, but the whole point was to spread the risk so that individual banks didn't have quite so much risk and thus make it more, you know, possible for more people to own homes. And Greenspan, being a libertarian true believer, in fact, being an Ayn Rand objectivist true believer, Alan Greenspan was inducted into the cult of Ayn Rand's worshippers, followers, whatever, in her apartment in the 1950s, 1956, as I recall. And Greenspan, you know, an absolute libertarian on this stuff, and saying, okay, let's do away with this rule, let's do away with that rule, let's do away with this rule. And now you've got these conservatives out there going, well, let's blame the victims, let's blame these individuals who went in and said, you know, I'd like to buy this house. Oh yeah, sure, we'll write the paper for that, but I don't have a job, or I'm only working as a cashier at Walmart. Well, that's no problem. Just put down that you're the vice president of a finance company, or put down that you own a car dealership or whatever, and I'll get you the. And it's a whoa. And, yeah, Greenspan thought this was just a fine thing. And it wasn't just Greenspan. I mean, again, we're back to the conservative philosophy. Paul in L.A. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, I was calling to talk to you about something else about ideology, but I'm going to take a left turn on you and talk about this subprime for a second because you're
okay,
left.
We've got about a minute before we've got to take a break.
Okay, you know, you're right about this fact with the packaging them up, but what you've got to understand is how they were leveraged. These hedge funds leveraged 1,000 to 1. This is why this thing is a big deal. They got leveraged up every stage of the way 10 times, 100 times, to the point where they were 1,000 to 1. The changing of the requirements, they told us why they did that.
Wait a minute. So you mean that they would have $1 million worth of mortgages bundled together, and they would borrow, what, $10 billion against that $1 million?
That's
is that
right.
1,000 to 1?
That's
if
right.
I'm
that's
doing
why
my.
That's why they're blowing up. And we just lost another two today. We got another shop that shut down. It's absolutely crazy. And it was intentional to get the consumer to spend on Fannie Mae, the Fed. Those are private corporations.
They are now. Yeah, they are now. Yeah, good point, Paul. And so the whole point was, let's inject more cash into the economy to make the economy look good. From the Bushies' point of view, meanwhile, borrowing $4 trillion that our children and grandchildren have to pay back. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hart.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, 1-866-303-2270, Richard in Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Just
I'm great. Oh, you're great. Good. I was just looking at an article from American Prospect, and I was talking about a guy named Scott Bloch, and he basically, or Bloch, B-L-O-C-H, mm-hmm. and he was a Bush loyalist, paleo-Catholic guy, who basically defended the administration, and he basically went up against the American Federation of Government Employees,
mm-hmm.
and he basically, hold on, I'm looking at the article real quick, the Office of Special Counsel started doing some investigation into this, and he had ousted some federal employees, and this is what got started the federal employees, the politicalization of these employees, you know, the investigations which Carl.
So you see, your point is this is. I would submit to you that the turning federal employees, and particularly the federal attorneys, into basically political hostages, really began with the ideology of all things are all about politics, Richard. But you know, your point is well taken, and I'll keep an eye out for the article. But this is, I mean. This goes back to Nixon. Arguably, this goes back to the Andrew Jackson administration. But, you know, the idea of federal appointees being political pawns is an old one. It's just that they've been doing it so clumsily and so you know, horrifically in this administration. Jurg in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Jurg.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. What's up?
First of all, let me commend you for your brilliance and accuracy regarding the facts you present every day in your show. I think it's incredible. I am actually a Swiss citizen. I'm living in the U.S. for the last 10 years, and I'd like just to add a quick comment pertaining to your previous conservatively misled guest, I would say.
Yeah. About the Swiss healthcare system.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And he said that he thinks that the Swiss healthcare system would actually be something that they would like to take over. And, you know, I think what he forgets to mention is that the American corporate health corporations actually only want the goodies picked out of the Swiss healthcare system. They forget to mention that we have a mandatory requirement of being insured. So a healthcare, an insurance cannot turn us down. Absolutely not. The only part that is actually privatized in our sector is the additional insurance. If you want to be like first class insured worldwide and so on and so forth, they can turn you down and there is some kind of a competition there. But
yeah, so if you want, let me just understand this here. If you're a Swiss citizen and you travel internationally and you want to buy insurance that covers you anywhere in the world and it will be paid out of Switzerland no matter where you show up and no matter what it costs, that's one private marketplace that's a competitive marketplace and you can buy that insurance. But if you're a Swiss citizen and you don't travel outside of Switzerland and you just want to protect yourself and your family, then is it a pure government? I mean, how does it work?
Well, basically, it's mandatory. You need to have an insurance. If you're registered in Switzerland, you need to have an insurance. You can't get around without it. And if you
right. Are the insurance companies for-profit or not-for-profit?
They're partially for profit. They are actually privatized, but there is a referendum going on right now where they want to have the whole thing actually taken over by the state. But my point is that, you know, it's mandatory for everybody to have it. For those who can't have it, can't afford it, then the state will kick in. That's where social medicine actually comes. And I think that's perfect because it actually balances it out a little bit between the people who pay privately and the people who pay into the Social Security.
Right, because I knew that there was a federal system, you know, a Medicare-type system that covered people regardless of their age in Switzerland. I just didn't realize what the threshold was. The threshold is income. Is
yeah,
that it?
That's exactly right. If you actually need support from the government, they will actually give that to you through the Social Security.
Right, whereas in the United States, it's basically age. If you're elderly or if you're severely infirm, but primarily if you're elderly, then you qualify for Medicare, and that's about it.
Yeah.
Jörg, thank you for enlightening us.
Thank you. Great show.
Much appreciated. Thank you very much. Mark in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, Tom. See, I heard your show last week when you were talking about China threatening to dump the trillion in U.S. dollars if we didn't quit talking about the coupling, discoupling of the yuan to the dollar.
Yeah, did you notice yesterday where I mentioned it on the air that now China is saying, oh, don't worry, we'll never do that.
Right.
And I'm wondering if they're like, you know, saying, well, you know, we've got this big stick in our hand, but in public we're going to talk about the carrot. But we still have the stick, you know, or
China,
if they've laid down the stick.
Yeah, China. And this related, when I put two and two together to, you know, in 94, Cheney said it would make no sense to go into Iraq. It would
right.
be, he illustrated exactly what would happen, and indeed that's what's happened. And then in 98, he changed his mind, all right, and advocated attacking. And my idea here, putting two to two together, would be that Cheney realized that the huge amount of debt that China held meant that they could destroy the U.S. economy anytime they wanted to drop that money. And he thought, what way could we protect ourselves from this huge vulnerability? And he thought, well, we could go into the Middle East, hold a knife against Iran's pipeline at any time, and then China would then dump the U.S. dollars. And that's why we're in China, or that's why we're in Iraq now. And then,
I suspect that probably was some part of the equation, but I think that really why we're in Iraq is a confluence of events. You had Bush, who saw it, and Karl Rove, who saw it purely in political terms. I mean, George Bush back in 1999, before when he was governor of Texas, before he was even running for president, saying that if he ever became president, he would invade Iraq because it would nail down political power for him. And then you had, you know, Cheney, who was looking at money for Halliburton and his buddies. And it was just a whole bunch of stuff thrown into a pot here, in my opinion. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging Rosina Hertzinger, who's going to be talking about healthcare in the free market. The CEO of Kaiser will be with us, George Halverson. And your calls, the rest of the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.